All right, everyone. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to the overview webinar on the draft analyses for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. My name is Maria Placht, and I work at the Army Corps of Engineers Institute for Water Resources. I'll be facilitating the webinar today. And we also have an AT&T technology moderator, Eddie DeLeon, who will be helping out with the platform. We're happy to have the following speakers on the phone today to go over various topics covered in the report. These are all members of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study team, and they'll be taking turns throughout the presentation sharing information, and they'll be available at the end for questions. Just a couple of points before we start on how the Q&A will work. We're going to have the overall Q&A session at the end of the presentations. So what I'd ask all of you to do is, as you have questions, feel free to go ahead and chat them in, and Eddie will explain the chat function in a minute. So you can chat in your questions as the presentations are unfolding throughout, and then at the end, we'll turn to those questions in the order that they came in, and we'll also at the end open the mic so you can ask verbal questions if you would like. So as the presenters are covering the material, feel free to direct any questions in the chat to specific presenters by name if you want. That's up to you. And don't forget also just to note that the call will be recorded and available along with the slides at afterwards. I think that's it for the opening remarks from our end. So I'd like to turn it over now to Dave Robbins, the project manager, to get us started.
Great. Thanks, Maria. Thanks, Eddie. And thanks to all the participants today to participate during today's webinar and your continuing interest in the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. My name is Dave Robbins. I'm a project manager here in the Planning Division, Baltimore District, Corps of Engineers. I'm going to review a few of the slides here as we open up our webinar today. Unfortunately, Amy Geis was unable to be available to participate during today's webinar, so I'll cover a few of her slides. So with the first slide here, the background, this is very general information. You've probably seen this before as the participants have been participating throughout our various webinar events that we've been holding. As we've gone through this North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study, we're all here today because Hurricane Sandy occurred at the end of October 2012 and affected the entire East Coast, particularly affecting the areas of New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. As a result, Congress enacted the Disaster Relief Appropriations Act at the end of January, which authorized this study and provided the appropriations to move forward. Next slide, slide. So included in the act was, again, the authorization, authorization is presented at the top of the screen, which is to conduct a comprehensive study to address the flood risk of vulnerable coastal populations as a result of Hurricane Sandy. Now, going through this this authorization and our scoping exercise, we identified the goals of this study, which are to provide a risk reduction framework, which is consistent with the Corps of Engineers and NOAA's rebuilding principles, the various principles that were developed following the Hurricane Sandy event at the end of 2012, and then also the way to further the discussion regarding the resilient coastal communities and identifying opportunities to support a sustainable coastal landscape systems, considering future vulnerabilities associated with climate change scenarios, sea level rise, as well as to reduce risk to vulnerable populations and the natural systems as well. Next slide. So the bottom line up front is we wanted to present in our draft analysis documentation are the findings, outcomes, and opportunities as a result of the comp study to date. The findings that we wanted to share today include the fact that it's a shared responsibility to address the vulnerability along the North Atlantic coast. As it was noted throughout the damage assessments completed following the Hurricane Sandy event, we identified that particularly low-lying shorelines were most susceptible or at least most vulnerable to storms, erosion, and even sea level rise. We also wanted to consider the fact that we need to improve storm risk management strategies, which incorporate robust, redundant, and a resilient array of strategies and management measures. We get into detail on that as part of our coastal storm risk management framework. I'll speak a little bit more in a moment. We also understand the fact that the interaction between the fluvial and coastal interface is going to change over the course of the next year, taking into account climate change and sea level rise. And additional further analysis would need to be required to better understand these interactions, the physics associated with the alluvial and riverine interactions, and also stormwater as a result of sea level rise in low-lying areas and how that could be affected by water surface elevations, mean sea level. Next slide. The outcomes, again, as far as the outcomes are concerned, we wanted to be able to present the various products of the COM study as a result of a two-year effort, which is the primary product is the Coastal Storm Risk Management Framework. This is the result of the COM study. We wanted to be able to present what is at risk and how to evaluate risk and future vulnerability along the North Atlantic coast. And the way that we did that was we took a look at the framework and broke it down by state, which includes 10 states from Virginia to New Hampshire. It includes the District of Columbia. So as part of that organization of our report documentation, we were able to present the various results of the framework and all the analyses that we've completed thus far, as you'll see in the report, in that by state for further coordination with our state partners. Collaboration was a very big component of the North Atlantic Coast Conference study and still is, as evidenced by the participation during today's webinar event and further coordination with our interagency stakeholders. We'll speak more to the collaboration in a few slides in a few minutes, but we just wanted to highlight again that collaboration is a very key component from the federal, tribal, state, local, NGOs, and academia going forward. We also wanted to close some of the data gaps and enhance the tools that are out there for decision makers and practitioners to further understand what are the risks and what are the vulnerabilities and what we can do about it. And as part of that closing the data gaps, we are going to present additional products associated with numerical modeling for the entire East Coast. We're looking to further the discussion regarding natural nature-based features as well as economic depth damage functions and how to adequately capture some of the economic damages that one could expect as a result of coastal storm risk management and coastal storm events. Next slide. So for the opportunities, we wanted to focus on how we could emphasize where are the opportunities to promote coastal resilience going forward. And as part of our documentation, we wanted to understand that there's dynamic collaboration required to move forward. As the science continues to evolve, we need to understand that we need to promote collaboration among the various federal agencies and other entities as well, for example, the non-government organizations and academia, to continue the dialogue and understand what is at risk, what are the future vulnerabilities, and what can we do about it. The creative incentives, we understand, as we mentioned in the findings, that we need to consider an array of resilient measures and strategies to address flood risk. And so from there needs to be opportunities for creative incentives to implement them. It is to implement strategies, to implement measures. And as part of that, as a lot of us are aware, that budgets are very much constrained at this point, so we need to be a little bit more creative, which ties into the public and private partnerships. We want to think about how those can be utilized going forward to identify opportunities for funding to address some of the risk and improve coastal communities by incorporating this array of resilient measures. Resource optimization, that will be key going forward, and is evident in the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. We wanted to be able to consider that the critical infrastructure is very much important as far as addressing risk within coastal communities. As was evident in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy in the New York, New Jersey area, critical infrastructure that supports the population needs to be addressed as far as resilience is concerned to be sure that communities can respond to future storm events. and future risks associated with coastal storms and sea level rise. Improvement in the implementation of national nature-based features. We wanted to be sure that there are opportunities between the federal and states to better understand and work together to implement national nature-based features in those areas that will be appropriate. And also flexibility and adaptive management. We understand that we need to incorporate risk-based planning, scenario-based planning, as well as adaptive management practices to address some of the uncertainty with the future conditions related to climate change and sea level rise. So definitely flexibility is a very important component that is an opportunity to consider as practitioners going forward. Next slide. So I'm going to shift gears here and talk a little bit about what's presented in what we refer to as the Coastal Storm Risk Management Framework. As part of the framework, and you'll see in some of the documentation that's presented to you, is we needed to identify the flood risk. What is flood risk? And so we utilize various floodplain inundation mapping to identify flood risk within the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study Area. And by identifying the inundation areas, we were able to identify who and what would be then exposed to that flood risk. And as part of that analysis, we were able to then think about what are the appropriate strategies, and under those strategies, the management measures associated with them to address the flood risk, and as well as how they're aligning with other regional plans that are being in development as part of this post-Sandy landscape. From there, we also wanted to identify relative costs associated with the management measures. So we have parametric unit costs prepared for the various management measures, and as well as what is the data available to make risk-informed decisions. We wanted to, as part of the framework, we wanted to be able to present how to evaluate risk, exposure, and vulnerability to better make risk-informed decisions, taking into account what, at a more local scale, at a community level, What is the information necessary for me to understand what is at risk, how sensitive is the community to that flood risk? Is, for example, even though you're in a floodplain, maybe all the structures are elevated such that the exposure to the flood hazard may be less than, for example, other areas. So we want to be able to explain what, and as part of the framework, how to think about those risk-informed decisions going forward with respect to addressing flood risk and future vulnerability assessments. And then what are the data gaps that need to be closed as part of the comprehensive study? And we mentioned a few of those as part of our opportunities in our findings, outcomes, and opportunities section of the report. Next slide. And so this is the last slide that I will be speaking to. Again, management measures. I wanted to focus a little bit more on the risk management measures component from the previous slide. Some of us on the call today were part of a working meeting in Hoboken, New Jersey last June. We'll speak a little bit more about that, but we wanted to think about what are the appropriate management measures across the study area, and the way we did that was to, again, break this management measures into various categories, structural, non-structural, and policy and programmatic, and then from there, within those categories, where would they be applicable based on shoreline types and other information? And so that's the way that we wanted to pull this together, and we wanted to focus on the structural component, which includes storm surge barriers, levees and flood walls, breakwaters, beach fill and dunes. Those are the types of structures that would offer a level of risk management to address higher magnitude storm events. Not to say that, however, that natural nature-based features as part of a combination of measures may not, would not provide some level of protection based on various site-specific location information, but we wanted to focus on the fact that natural nature-based features do provide some level of risk management, particularly as it relates to wave attenuation, floodplain storage, et cetera. But we wanted to capture those types of features as part of our structural risk management measures. Non-structural risk management measures, we wanted to capture floodproofing, elevation, and acquisition. Those are typical non-structural solutions to acclimate to a flood risk. That is, you understand that a flood hazard will occur and there may be floodwaters, but there are ways to mitigate the damages associated with it, as well as flood warning systems. We wanted to tie into, as you'll see in some of the documentation, into hurricane evacuation studies and the work that goes into developing those studies. And then obviously policy and programmatic is a large component to coastal management zones and as well as flood insurance. That's going to be a big item going forward as well as it relates to how communities are affected by risk going forward. So we wanted to capture those opportunities to address some of the institutional other barriers which may oftentimes are associated with policy issues as part of our measures that we seek to go forward as part of our coastal storm risk management framework. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Maria.
Thanks, Dave. Next, we're going to go to Carla Roberts, the study manager, to hear a bit about the coordination that's been involved with this report.
Great. Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Maria. My name is Carla Roberts, and I am a study manager with the Baltimore District Corps of Engineers, and I sit in the planning division. So what I'm going to present are just two quick slides to talk a little bit about some of the collaboration and coordination that's been done to date as a part of the study. So the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study incorporates expertise in coastal planning, engineering, and science from across the Corps enterprise. The Corps of Engineers Coastal Storm Risk Management National Planning Center of Expertise, Institute for Water Resources, and Engineering Research and Development Center are all significant contributors leading several key technical components. Various federal partners and subject matter experts have also been working with the technical teams to ensure a comprehensive and collaborative set of analysis. To date, four working meetings have been held as a part of the analysis, including a measures meeting, modeling meeting, and two meetings related to natural and nature-based features. The measures meeting included a diverse set of stakeholders who provided their expertise and information, which helped us to develop our measures matrix and further highlight innovative solutions to coastal storm risk management. A modeling working meeting was also held, which pulled together scientists and engineers to evaluate the scope of the modeling effort, which prompted discussion on topics such as coastal flooding, storm surge, wave systems, climate change, and model development, among other things. Two working meetings related to natural and nature-based features were held this past fall, one covering technical aspects of the discipline and another discussing the policy challenges associated with implementing such features. The study team has held five collaboration webinars that many of you may have participated in last fall or winter, as well as two webinars specific to our tribal stakeholders. We've solicited peer-reviewed information through a Federal Register notice last fall and received information from institutions such as Rutgers, for example. Finally, we reached out through mailings and email on multiple occasions to our federal, state, and non-governmental organizations, subject matter experts, or point of contact. A full list of information we solicited, as well as more detail on many of the events I just discussed, can be found in Section 3 of the main report, which is titled Interagency Alignment and Communication. Our study team has also completed over 100 strategic engagements, which include discussions and or briefings with federal, state, and regional agencies or organizations at multiple levels. We've most recently conducted 7 visioning sessions, which provide an opportunity to hold discussions with areas along the coast on topics such as risk, resilience, sea level change, and others. This information will help to inform our study on each of those particular topics. And to conclude my discussion on collaboration to date, I just wanted to highlight some fun facts about our public website, which offers study information and archive of our webinars and other presentations to date, as well as an opportunity for the public to provide input related to coastal resilience. As of earlier this month, our site has had over 5,000 visits, over 7,500 page views, and we have accumulated a subscriber list of over 150 individuals. We encourage you all to share the website and an option to subscribe to all who are interested in the study and its progress. And I'll again remind you, for those of you that haven't been to our website, you can go there. It's www.nad.usace.army.mil/compstudy. And at this time, I would like to pass it to Kelly Burks-Coates, who will speak a little bit about natural and nature-based features and how they are incorporated into the comprehensive study.
Thank you, Carla, and thank you, Dave. As Dave mentioned earlier in this presentation, there are many opportunities to formulate the recovery plans using a wide range of measures, including the use of natural and nature-based features in combination with structural options to promote flood risk reduction and coastal resiliency across the entire study area. Just so everybody is on the same page, we define natural features as those features that have been created or evolved over time through the actions of physical, biological, geologic, and chemical processes operating in nature. Nature-based features are those that may mimic the characteristics of these natural features, but they're created by human design, engineering, and construction to provide specific surfaces, such as coastal risk reduction. The built components of the system can include, as Dave mentioned, nature-based or other structures that support the range of objectives, including like erosion control and storm risk reduction, seawalls and levees, for example, as well as infrastructure providing economic and social functions, navigation channels, or residential housing, for example. So when I say NMBF, or we say NMBF, we're actually talking about things like dune swell complexes, reefs, marshes, beaches, and even living shorelines that can be combined or blended with structural features to meet their recovery objectives. Of course, integrating the NMBF features into the recovery efforts will require some strategic thinking and a great deal of collaboration with the local stakeholders, partners, and other authorities, as we've already mentioned. For the report, we've included an entire appendix and a chapter that lays out the NMBF evaluation and implementation framework, and it focuses on basically three steps: alignment, evaluation, and implementation. The appendix begins by discussing the identification of NMBF opportunities and identifying all the relevant authorities and interests germane to a given area of project and organizing that kind of communication about these authorities so that we can appropriately frame the technical evaluation of NMBF. Then we go into an evaluation process where we offer details describing and defining the geomorphological setting and offering a conceptual strategy to assess vulnerability and formulate resilient solutions. Evaluation techniques and performance metrics in the form of ecosystem goods and services are presented so that different options can be compared in terms of success in meeting the project goals and objectives. Then we can discuss, or we begin to discuss, the use of things like regional sediment management techniques and describe optimizing the beneficial use of materials for NMBF features. We even offer a series of case studies to demonstrate how to implement the NMBF and monitor the effects through adaptive management. And we discuss at the end the debates about policy and implications of surrounding US the NMBF in these solutions. The appendix kind of wraps up with a discussion of paths forward. We highlight the need to establish a community practice, drawing in a diversity of organizations interested in contributing to NMBF practices and promoting the idea of developing sound technical guidance that defines good practice in evaluating, designing, constructing, monitoring, and maintaining NMBF blended solutions for the NACCS. In addition to the appendix and the chapter in the main report, as Carla mentioned, we've held two workshops on NMBF back in the fall to start exploring and aligning these concepts and to get feedback on directions and opportunities. There are also three webinars posted out on the NACCS webpage that can give you more information about NMBF specifically. There's one on vulnerability assessments, and there's also one on quantification of goods and services associated with NMBF options. And with that, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Kelly. Next up, we've got Jason Engel, who's going to talk about sea level rise and climate change adaptation.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jason Engel. I'm a coastal engineer from the Jacksonville District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and I'm the climate science change leader for the North Atlantic Comp Study. I'm going to give a brief overview of this work, but I'd like to mention up front that we are going to be having a webinar specific to this topic in the second week of April, and everyone that's on the mailing list for this webinar will be getting an invitation to that webinar. So there will be quite a bit more information in that dedicated webinar. So I'll go rapidly through a fairly substantial amount of work and answer questions today, but keep in mind that quite a bit more information will be presented in a few weeks. So incorporation of climate change to date, we've completed evaluation of relative sea level rise scenarios for 23 locations. There's been GIS mapping of relative sea level rise at the 50 and 100 year time horizons. We have a statistical analysis of extreme water levels, which have a climate change, sea level change component. And then there are ongoing work to discuss climate change adaptation methods and examples, and to incorporate sea level change scenarios into numerical modeling of storms. This last item will be talked about briefly today, but in its incorporation of sea level rise into the modeling has just begun. Next slide, please. Okay, so the relative sea level rise scenarios that we're using for the COMP study are a combination of the Army Corps of Engineers scenarios, which are in the document at the top, and the NOAA High scenario. There's an overlap between the Army Corps of Engineers and NOAA scenarios. We've chosen the highest NOAA scenario to make sure that we're covering the full range of scenarios that the federal government has adopted. We computed these for 35 locations across the study area at NOAA long-term water level gauge locations, and then we used those numbers for sea level rise mapping. Next slide. Now, another component of this was combined extreme water levels and relative sea level rise. So a subset of those same NOAA water level gauges were used to do a statistical analysis of extreme water levels. So these would be the water levels that occur during storm events or flood events that have been recorded by these water level gauges. There are 23 such gauges. And there, as I said, on the left, and it's an example of the historical extreme water level data. You can see the vertical axis is the water level in North Atlantic vertical datum of 1988 in meters. And then the return period. So you see a 10 or 100 or 1,000 year return period, and you can see the water levels associated. This example comes from Sandy Hook, New Jersey, which is an open ocean water level gauge. On the right-hand side, you see the addition of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers high sea level rise scenario. And you can see that while on the left-hand side, Sandy had approximately a 400-year return period, a water level would occur every 20 years if we were to see this high sea level rise scenario. So I'm giving some kind of a context about the impact of combining these extreme water levels and relative sea level rise. What I would like to say is that this is considered a preliminary analysis. This is to get an order of magnitude. The numerical modeling that's going to be discussed next is going to incorporate all of the sea level rise with a very detailed look at storm climatology and physics so that that when the study is ultimately concluded in January of 2015, there will be a database and very detailed information about the incorporation of storms or the combination of storms and extreme water levels in sea level rise. Next slide. So the ongoing work, climate change adaptation methods and examples. This is decision support given climate and response uncertainty. This is a scenario-based analysis. And one of the concepts that we introduce is the concept of low regret measures. So the types of measures that have benefits under current climate and future climate. This will be discussed in more detail at our webinar in a couple of weeks. And finally, what's ongoing is the incorporation of these sea level rise scenarios into the numerical modeling of the storms. And I'll pass it back to the moderator.
Thanks, Jason. Next up, we've got Lynn Bocamazzo to talk a little more about the numerical modeling.
Good afternoon. My name is Lynn Bocamazzo. I am the engineering technical lead for the comprehensive study, and I sit at the New York District Army Corps of Engineers. I have just a few slides about the coastal storm numerical modeling that we're undertaking under the COMP study. This modeling study is being undertaken to refine the regional storm sweeps for storm surges and wave forces from Maine through Virginia. We are using very detailed ADCIRC circulation model, and also we're using SC-Wave wave model and the WAM wave model to do that. So we are trying to develop waves and water levels for risk assessment and design for future studies. This is a very large undertaking, and we do not expect to complete it until December of 2014, and the report will be available when the entire comp study is complete. We are trying to define the coastal storm probability space, both using extratropical and tropical events, so that, again, we can understand the coastal risk and do assessments and have it for project design. We will store the information that comes out of the modeling study, and I'll give you some details about that in a slide to come up, under our CStorm database application. So all the parameters that we are measuring and will model, including water surface elevations, water and wind velocity, wave conditions, will be stored under the CStorm database. And that data will all be available on a website. We already have a CStorm database that's being used in the Great Lakes and in other places around the country. And it's being updated presently, and we will use the same web-based interface. And so the data that comes out of the numerical storm modeling will be available to all. Next slide. So just want to give you some snapshots of some of the work that has been completed to date. The ADCIRC mesh has been developed. So this is the circulation model mesh. It includes areas of the Western Atlantic Ocean, Gulf of Mexico, but we go all the way from Canada all the way down to South America. We have a tighter grid from Maine through Virginia. We have the save points, which we are also calling co-location points. We asked our points of contact throughout the North Atlantic region where they would like data to be saved. Again, it's the water levels and wave data from the storm surge modeling. With discussion throughout the Corps of Engineers and reaching back to the POCs from our states, we asked where those data should be saved. And you can see on the bottom right-hand corner, there are some projects there in southern New Jersey. That's just an example. But the final outcome for the data save points, there are over almost 19,000 what we're calling high-frequency co-location points, and data that will be the outcome, again, waves and water levels from this numerical modeling study will be saved at each of these points and available for future use. Next slide. One of the things that we had to do, and actually all this work is being done at the Coastal and Hydraulics Lab, is to develop what storms would be considered in the storm suite. This is the censoring model, how we went from 24 water level gauges with 300 years of record length and identified 250 storms. We will be modeling 100 extra tropical storms out of that suite of available storms. Next slide. We also have to censor for the tropical storms. And we took all 1,736 storms in the North Atlantic Basin, looked at landfalling and bypassing, and developed which of the historical tropical storms will be used for this study. Now, those are only the tropicals. Those are only the historical storms. We are also developing synthetic storms to cover the probability space to be used to develop the full frequency range from very frequent to very infrequent for the North Atlantic. We're also using these tropical storms for validation, for the sea level rise analysis, and as I said, for the synthetic storm. We are presently validating the model. As we speak, the model is being validated on approximately 20 storms, both extratropical and tropical. Next slide. I'm finished, and I'm going to turn it over to Naomi Frankel regarding economics.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm Naomi Frankel. I am the Chief Economist for North Atlantic Division. And like Lynn, the economics for this section of the economics for the North Atlantic Coastal Comprehensive Study is actually a long-term effort that will be completed at later in the time period of the study. And essentially what we're doing is refining the depth damage relationships used in core studies. So what does this mean? Corps of Engineers projects are subjected to a rigorous cost-benefit analysis through which they are justified for construction. We understand, I'm sure, what the costs are, but what are the economic benefits to coastal storm damage reduction? So the way that Corps calculates benefits to a coastal storm damage reduction measure is the benefits are the bad things that didn't happen because you had some project in place. So if something didn't get destroyed because a core project was there, that's a benefit to having the core project. To know the damages you avoid by having a project in place, you develop what's called a depth damage relationship. And what this is going to tell you is that if you had 5 feet of flooding, and you know how much flooding you had because of gauges and because of record storm, perhaps, without a project in place, it's going to give you 50% damage to a structure in a specific area. Essentially, if you have the project in place, that damage doesn't happen, and that's a benefit to having it. So the Corps has a series of generic depth damage functions it uses. But these are based on fluvial events, which is essentially riverine events. And as we all know, a coastal storm and a fluvial storm are very different, and they have different mechanisms of damage. So these new depth damage functions are going to better reflect coastal events, especially in urban areas. And if you've had a look at the study, one thing that you'll notice is that 5 of the 9 areas that are selected for future focus are actually in urban areas. So this is something that the Corps just doesn't have yet, and that we're hoping to make better. And we're filling knowledge gaps. So essentially, I have 4 studies going on right now that are going to help with depth damage estimates and help us figure out what the benefits to these storms are, benefits to the measures against the storms are. And one of them is measuring the direct physical effects of the Hurricane Sandy so that we can better estimate what the economic consequences are. So this is looking at physical damages from the storm, which is not just inundation, which you get from a fluvial storm, but also wave attack and erosion. Another effort we have going on is development of what are called depth emergency cost curves. So you can figure out the relationship of the depths of flooding to the emergency costs incurred. And again, if you don't incur the emergency costs because there's a measure in place, then that's a benefit to having the measure. The next thing we're doing is we're gathering data from the storm to refine what the Corps calls the depth fatality model, so we can better estimate the effects of a coastal storm. And finally, one of our catch-all categories is looking at lines of causation for secondary and tertiary effects to inform development of how we apply them to core benefit calculations. One thing that we noticed in what happened in Sandy were there are bad things that happened that we really never put a value on. For example, I call this the Cliff Jones method, but essentially if you live on Long Island and your basement is flooded and you lose your boiler, well, one thing that happens if you live on Long Island and you lose your boiler, probably 100,000 of your neighbors also lost their boiler. And the fact is, you're not going to have a boiler for 3 months because there just aren't enough boilers and they're not made on 34th Street anymore. So we're trying to look at things like that that don't usually get counted as, problems from a storm, and at least put together a compendium so that we can look at that. Can consider them later and think about them as in our benefit calculations. So with that, I'm going to turn this back over to Dave Robbins to move on in the presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Naomi. Okay, again, what happens next? So this is it concludes the topic overview as far as the presentation is concerned. We just want to provide some information on the next steps of the study and what you could expect as a participant. As far as where we are, we submitted the draft analyses. And again, the information that was submitted is not a draft report, it's draft analyses as part of the comprehensive study and our collaboration effort. We wanted to get input from our interagency team before we actually have a draft report so that we can present to you what it is that's in the report at this point in time as a result of our draft analyses, and then from there be able to capture that input and then ultimately refine the report into the next iteration, which is ultimately the draft report that would move forward for its progression towards Congress. And so this slide here that you're viewing is the timeline and milestones to present the next step. So at this point in time, you should have received the draft analysis documentation via email. We have a specific email list to present that information to our stakeholders previously coordinated throughout the last several months of the study. Once you take a look at the report and you respond to our comment form, we will receive the comments and integrate them into the report. We will not be responding to comments. The process, based on the volume of comments anticipated, we will be collating comments to the various themes, and we will present various responses to various themes of comments that we receive as part of this interagency review period. And then from there, that time frame would occur between now and through the middle of April, so that from the middle of April through the end of June, the comprehensive study team will be able to, one, complete the remaining analyses that are being conducted, as was alluded to previously, as well as to take the information that we've pulled together independently, as well as the feedback from this interagency review, and integrate into the draft documentation the draft analyses and formulate the draft report. And that draft final report with production will take the month of June into the summer, ultimately leading to our internal review processes beginning in July through the end of this year, ultimately resulting in our draft report submission to Congress by the end of January 2015 as prescribed in the authorization language. So that's what happens next. As far as the review information, again, you should have received an email from me or from an automated file transfer service to allow access to our documentation. Again, these are draft analyses. They are not for distribution. They were distributed to our list of previously coordinated points of contact within our state, federal, state, tribal, NGOs, and academia. So that's if you receive that email from me or from an automated source that is specifically for you and for coordination among your agency. So at this point, the file transfer service that I alluded to is referred to as AMRDEC. It's an U.S. Army data transfer service. And the email, automated email that was generated as part of that service, which was submitted last Friday, is noreply@amrdec.army.mil. So we've been communicating throughout today with various participants on issues resulting from spam filters. So we'll be looking into that now as far as how we can get that information through to you to address these issues, technical challenges and issues. So at this point, as part of the overview documentation, what you hear today, as well as the information that's presented to you in the draft analyses, we want you to take a look at and review and comment on what you see so that we can take that information and collate it and formulate our various themes that we want to pull from this review period to capture that in our documentation that's ultimately submitted to Congress. We want to be sure that this is a collaborative exercise and that we seek your input and feedback, and we want to be able to document it. And if you take a look at the documentation, we have a separate appendix for our coordination and collaboration effort, and that's where the results of this collation and synthesis of the comments into various themes will be presented. So from there, at this point, once you receive the automated message, you should have received it on Friday. And again, today we're working around a workaround. If you did not receive it, you probably received a message from me. File the link to include it in that message to the feedback form. It is an online form for you to submit comments to general questions to focus your review, but they're open-ended questions for you to provide your feedback. We ask that you, again, refer to our subject-specific webinars. We'll speak a little bit to that in a moment, but Jason alluded to that, where we wanted to have an additional webinars where we devote additional time on various topics of interest so that you can receive that feedback during this comment period, so that you can receive that information during this comment period to help formulate your comment. And then from there, all feedback forms would be required to be submitted by April 14th of next month. So it's a 30-day review period. Subject-specific webinars, we'll be sending out these invitations via Outlook, similar to what occurred for this particular webinar later this week. We wanted to focus the next four webinars on risk, exposure, and vulnerability, and how those concepts were addressed as part of the Coastal Storm Risk Management Framework. The strategies and management measures, including the natural and nature-based features, we want to speak to the opportunities for the strategies to address flood risk and what are the management measures associated with them, and the thought that being able to combine and develop an array of strategies and measures to address not only the existing vulnerabilities and risks, but also the future vulnerabilities as is uncertain associated with climate change and sea level rise. And again, Jason mentioned that specific webinar as well related to the sea level rise analysis, the relative sea level rise analysis, as well as the thoughts that are going into the climate change adaptation section of our report. And also, we wanted to focus, again, on institutional and other barriers. We wanted to be able to speak to what are the existing challenges, successes, and opportunities to address institutional and other barriers. Obviously, we want to focus on some policy issues, but we wanted to have a separate webinar to speak to those items as well. So again, following up with the conclusion of this webinar, we just want to be able to mention that we are, your point of contact will be me, Dave Robbins, to address the technical challenges with accessing the document and comment forms, general issues, or further coordination activities. If you are interested in submitting a comment but you don't know who your agency POC is, we can work with you to identify who that person is. Please contact me via email so we can work with various team members and include various team members on various correspondence as appropriate to be sure that we can get information to you. So with that, I'll conclude the presentation period, and we'll throw it back to Maria.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks very much to all the presenters for that overview. Next, we wanted to go into a question and answer discussion period with everybody on the line. We really appreciate the fact that you guys have all called in to listen to this information, and we want to hear from you about this and any questions you might have. So we're going to have both the chat and the hand-raising option at this point. So let me just check in with Eddie to review the process that you guys need to follow for that.
Absolutely. So just first, a brief reminder to our participants, if you would like to ask a question, you may use the send note button or the chat box on your screen and submit your questions to all moderators or presenters. If you prefer to ask your questions over the phone lines, you may dial *1 on your phone, or you may use the raise hand icon located in the top left of your screen. You will be notified once your line is unmuted, at which point you may proceed to state your name and your question. So you may submit your questions via chat, or you may dial *1 if you prefer to ask a question over the phone.
Great. Thanks, Eddie. So I think we'll go ahead and start with the questions that we've already got in the chat box that came up during the presentations, and then we'll turn it over to the phones, as I see a couple people raising their hands already. So the first one I'll direct to Dave Robbins. The question is, can the PowerPoint presentation be provided electronically? Should we need to review later?
Thanks, Marianne, and thank you to whoever ask that question. Again, as Carla mentioned, we will make this information available on our website, our public website. We posted our previous webinar events on a webpage link on that on our project-specific webpage. So we envision that these webinars, again, that are being recorded, will, as in addition to the slides, will be made available in a similar fashion on our public webpage. And again, that's nad.usace.army.mil/comstudy.
Thanks, Dave. I'd also like to direct the next question to you as well. This one is from Matthew Wall. And he says, in the Virginia appendix, I noticed that the various areas, VA1, VA2, et cetera, infrastructure analysis, seem very unevenly reviewed and detailed. It appears that areas with less risk got more detail, for example, VA1, than the areas of highest risk, for example, VA2. Will there be more info gathered and increased detail relayed in this document to more accurately reflect the focus of, on the risk levels of the areas being studied?
The quick answer is yes. Again, as I alluded to the fact that these are draft analyses, we went through internal review, but that's not to say that we wanted to get through this to get to a point where we can, again, have you provide input to us as well. What are the, if you have information or other facts about some of these areas, Matthew, that may not have been captured, we want to be sure that we do capture it. And so, again, this is the purpose of this collaboration effort and comment period is, again, part of the comment period, you can provide some of that feedback to us for consideration. But again, the quick answer is that they're draft analyses, and we'll be reviewing the document and elaborating on some of the narratives presented in these draft analyses to develop the next iteration of the report documentation, which will be a draft report form.
Thanks, Dave. The next question I'd like to give to Lynn Bocamazzo to start, this is from Mark Smith, and he says, it appears the coastal storm modeling did not include Massachusetts Bay. Is that correct? If so, why is that the case?
Hi, this is Lynn. No, that is not correct. Perhaps it was the size of the figure. There was quite a bit of work done. There had been an ADSERC mesh already in Massachusetts Bay, but there was quite a bit of work done to refine it and make it more accurate, current bathymetry and topography. So a lot of work was done in Massachusetts Bay, in Cape Cod, to make sure that it is accurate. I do have some figures, and I'm not sure if people are going to be sending more specific questions, but they can be shared very specifically about the New England coast and how much extra work was done there. There was another question from Alan Springett. Perhaps I'm only the one who saw it. And Alan wrote, SWAN was not coupled to ADSERC to develop the wave information, question mark. And Alan, the answer is no. We are using ST-Wave and WAM with this model.
Thanks, Lynn. That's a great point. Some participants may be chatting directly to presenters. So if you see a question come in to you, definitely let me know, and I can pause at certain points to check in with all of you. The next question I think I'd like to give to Naomi. This is from Matthew Wall, and he says, FEMA has done a lot of depth damage function work for V zones and coastal A zones for calculating benefit costs for mitigation grants. Is the Corps working in tandem with FEMA? If not, would it be beneficial to do so?
So the answer to that is that we are looking at what FEMA did, but honestly, the FEMA, the way they do their depths, do their economic analysis is a little bit less rigorous than ours, and they have a little bit, I think their benefit cost ratio standard is 0.75, where ours is 1, and what they look at is actually different. So we're looking at that as a basis. We're using a lot of FEMA NFI, a lot of NFIP data. We are definitely communicating FEMA, but we are not using we are not necessarily building on what they.
Thanks, Naomi. All right, so next question. I think I will pass to Dave. The question is, what is the URL of data updated online? So I think just repeating that, what was already stated, but specifically, is GIS mapping data of relative sea level rises in 50 and 100 years available online? Is gathered data in the economics part of the study to refine current depth fatality model available online?
Yeah, yeah. Just to let you know, the URL, we're working through that. You should have a specific link that was provided to you in an automated message to allow access to the report. And included in the message delivering that is a link to the comment forms where you would be able to populate your comments in response to various comments. In response to various questions that are presented to you. And from there, I think as far as data that's available currently, again, everything is in draft form, but we wanted to be sure to let you know that it currently is in draft form in our documentation, but at the end we'll have a spatial geo database that's available for the public. That'll be available for download, where we'll include the inundation mapping as well. But is this information economic? At this point, as Naomi mentioned regarding your question about the inundation from sea level rise, focused on the economics components, primarily the depth fatality relationship. Again, as Naomi mentioned, that work is going on a separate track and is currently not going to be joined to what our analysis is showing with respect to sea level rise inundation. I suspect future studies will be able to consider that as these products, again, as we mentioned before, as we close the gap on some of these analyses and better the science, we'll be able to make some of those inference part of future investigations.
So are the depth fatality relationships that the core uses, essentially these get fit into a model called HEC-FIA? And what we're doing with the coastal depth fatality relationships that we get from Sandy information is we're essentially establishing a frame to use these in HEC-FIA. HEC-FIA currently is really limited to things like dam breaks, which is altogether a different mechanism. So we're supplementing what we already have.
Thanks, Naomi. And at this point, I'd like to go ahead and go to the phones before we go through more of the questions in the chat box. Eddie will let you guys on the phone go ahead and speak, but when you start, please introduce yourself.
Carrie, you may go ahead.
Hello, this is actually Naomi Edelson in Octara. We're all looking at one computer with the National Wildlife Federation. And it's a tremendous amount of work that's been done, and I'm really looking forward to reading the specific sections of the report and providing some comments. And I guess I just wanted to understand a little bit more two parts of this. I know there was a decision made not to have public comments, not to put it out for full public comments, and I'm just curious about why, because I know this is very important to a lot of the stakeholders in that region, and I know you're working with a lot of them, but I just wanted to understand more of that process. And I also just wondered about the time frame. It seems like it's a short time frame to get a lot of feedback, like you said, and seems like that's a really valuable part of this, is to make sure you're getting the input and integrating it, and I'm just wondering about that short time frame when the study is in fact not due for another, 6 to 8 months.
Dave, would you like to take that one?
Sure. Yes. Thank you. I just wanted to reiterate the fact again. It is a very short time frame, and a lot of the participants on the line may understand what it would take to get a report from a federal agency to Congress. So we definitely needed to account for the time necessary or the duration to get through various internal reviews to get there. That's not a slight to our own organization. That's just the reality that we're faced with. However, as it relates to the actual public comment period, there was no requirement for us to actively seek public involvement as part of the comp study. There was not a NEPA document associated with this. It was not included in authorization. That's not to say, however, that we wanted to make information available to the public. We wanted to provide information on our webpage to provide information on where we're going with this as far as the comp study is concerned and the progress of it. We also initiated information on the Federal Register. We indicated that the study was being conducted. We also solicited peer review information, as Carla suggested. But this time, you know, if we're not required to have public information and the scale at which we're working, we really wanted to be able to kind of take a higher look at this and recognize the fact that the public may, the appropriate input for the public would be at a smaller scale where they could provide that site-specific, the societal input for those specific communities into the risk, vulnerability, and what to do about it discussions at a more local level, at a more refined scale. So that's the way we're working through the public involvement phase. Also, you know, the time frame is an issue, as we mentioned. To be able to work through the draft analysis as we've done, coordinate with our interagency team, as well as work with our own organization to get a report available to release to the public, there really wasn't much time available to do that. So we have definitely acknowledged the interest, and we wanted to be able to make information available to the public, and we've done that. It's just we acknowledge the fact that due to the time constraints and the congressionally mandated time frame to complete the study, as well as the broad scale and the vast study area, we just can't speak to everyone, as evidenced by some of our coordination here today.
Thank you. I appreciate that information. I'm sorry, I meant to also ask, is there specific kinds of feedback that you really would like the most? Like, are you really looking more for technical accuracy or more other kinds of things that would be most helpful?
Yes, you'll see when you click the link, there's a comment form to focus the discussion, and it definitely includes some of the technical components. For example, Matt's comment earlier about being able to provide the appropriate level of detail in the documentation. We want to be able to acknowledge that. So the technical component, policy issues, we definitely want to hear from anyone regarding policy issues that need to be highlighted as part of this documentation that is sent to Congress so that we can speak as one voice, if you will, to our elected leaders on the importance as it relates to coastal management, coastal risk, and resilience, and then ultimately what we can do about it.
Great. Thanks, Dave, and thanks for the question. Let's go to the next person that has their hands raised on the phone.
Hello, this is Bradley Pervancha. I'm with Department of Defense, Washington Headquarters Services, Facility Services. My area of responsibility includes the Pentagon and about 100 buildings in the National Capital Region. My question is, I'm looking on your website, and there was an outstanding presentation in the December time frame from Dr. Smith in Fairfax. It had to do with policy challenges and institutional barriers. My question is about what's the most senior level folks that have been engaged in this process to date? For example, if we come up with these requirements to better protect our facilities, are our senior leaders already on board and begun to draft policy, perhaps submit favorable legislation, DOD gets our funding through the National Defense Authorization Act. Can we expect some funding, some policy changes in the future, perhaps some congressional action for funds to be earmarked? Or when we bring a climate adaptation planning type of a project to them, do those policymakers become part of the barriers as opposed to part of the solutions? Basically, are they involved and engaged and supportive in providing us some top cover at this point?
So thank you for that question. Dave, would you like to start with that one?
Sure, that's a very important question that I'll try to do my best to answer. At this point, most of us are aware of the presidential task force that was stood up following the Hurricane Sandy recovery phase. And so as part of that effort, a lot of the senior leaders of the various federal agencies were involved in that, in the development of developing those, rebuilding report that was issued back in August. And so from there, there are various recommendations that came out of that report. And so a lot of the folks on this line, including us here in our organization, the Corps, we've been working with our leaders at headquarters, have been apprised of the progress of the study, as well as some of the information that's been, we've been pulling forward as it's been developed. So our senior leaders, at this time, we understand that senior leaders are aware of some of the recommendations from the task force. The task force references this particular document, the comm study that the Corps is preparing, that would be submitted to Congress. So there should be some linkages between the various federal agencies, particularly at a high level, as you mentioned, to be able, provide that top cover to support some of the suggestions and inferences that are being made and pulling that forward as part of this documentation.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. That's comforting to us. What we're seeing at our level is a lot of a little bit more narrow focus. As an example, there's been a lot of activity on South Sandy lessons learned, but narrowly focused on things like power restoration. And we see climate adaptation as a multi-threat type of environment with lots of solutions, lots of risk, and lots of costs to remediate those various risks. So thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you both. The next question I'd like to direct to Jason Engel, and I think it's from Carreeves. The question is, the climate change modeling is excellent. Can you tell us the resolution available, and how will this information be shared among the many users that will want it?
Right. I guess, and I'm a little bit unclear on this, but I assume when you say climate change modeling, the part that I'm able to address would be the climate change estimates that were done at the 23 NOAA water level gauge locations. Those data are available, the full version of those are in the draft, so we have those estimates for those 23 locations. I would say, though, that the really powerful product that's going to come out of this study in terms of this is the numerical modeling that's being done that Lynn Bocamazzo briefed. That will have much more comprehensive and detailed coverage, particularly in the interior shoreline areas, the bays and the rivers that may be the most vulnerable to flooding, are going to be covered in detail in that modeling. Those are not very well covered by water level gauge measurements, and hence the analysis done for the gauge measurements is not, it doesn't present a complete picture of sea level rise and combined with extreme water level vulnerability. So the numerical modeling is really going to be a rather large upgrade in what we know about that. So I would encourage those that are interested to stay tuned, and once all the numerical modeling is, completed in January of 2015, that will provide a rather up-to-date, high-tech, reliable data set.
Thanks, Jason. While you were talking, I saw a hand go up. So it might have been the person trying to clarify further. So let's go to the phones. And if whoever raised your hand, if it's not related to that previous comment and it's a separate question, that's fine too. We can cover it first before moving on.
Okay, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
You can. This is Alan Springer from FEMA Region 2. I was wondering, in conjunction with that, there's going to be a lot of these models run. Is there going to be an archive set up so that in a future event, this archive could be queried, and if a particular storm happens to start following the parameters for one of those storms, you could actually have an operational aspect to this information rather than just a planning aspect? Is it considered that there will be a searchable archive that these storm runs will be put into? Thanks.
Hi, this is Lynn Bocamazzo. I briefly said the words CStorm DB, and the DB is the database. And so that will be a searchable archive. This model won't be operational, but we, for example, we did have other models in the metropolitan area of New York that were operational just post-Sandy. So it wasn't prior to Sandy, but it was just post-Sandy that we did exercise very quickly, ADCERC model to develop water levels. So it can be done. It's not going to be, post-storm. It's not going to be an operational model. It's not going to be, like NOAA has a forecasting model. But it will be available if called on. But the other question, your first question was, will the outcome of the model be searchable? Yes, in this database that is web-based. They're doing upgrades right now, and the upgrades will surely be finished by the time the comprehensive study is complete. And then all the outputs, all those stations I mentioned, about 19,000 stations, will have all the outputs from all the numerical model runs available.
Thank you. All right, and so next we have actually just a couple comments, so I'll just read them off and see if any of the presenters wanted to say anything about them. The first comment is actually from Alan, and he says that the FEMA benefit cost analysis is one. And then the second comment is from Amy Tars, and she says, regarding FEMA's depth damage curve coordination, I did check with Jody Springer at FEMA, and he said they intend to adopt the Corps' updated depth damage curve. So on those two points, any of the presenters want to respond?
That's great news that FEMA wants will adopt what we have. I mean, I guess I must have some misinformation, but in my experience with Rebuild by Design, when they were presenting how they do their cost-benefit analysis, the presenter was actually quite specific that they were using 0.75, and I actually was very a little bit surprised about that. So maybe it was a miscommunication.
Thanks, Naomi. And for everyone on the line, that was Naomi Frankel with the economics team.
Sure. I actually have another econ question here from Fadi Kara, who says, have you developed Sandy models and databases on depth emergency cost estimation? Fadi, that's actually what's going on right now. Our emergency cost survey is, in fact, the depth emergency cost estimation, which is being done essentially through a series of interviews with emergency service providers.
Thanks, Naomi. Yes, let's check in with the other presenters. Any chat to you directly that I'm not seeing here in the list? All right, so let's keep going. So the next series of questions I have is from Hans Moritz. And I think, Jason, I'll start with you for these. And you can pass it on to one of the other presenters if you want. So there's three questions, and I'll just stop after each one. The first one is, are coastal flooding vulnerabilities prioritized within the NACCS area in terms of present risk in 20 years, 50 years, et cetera?
The answer to that is no, that the risk is not quantified for those time frames. And I think it goes back to my earlier comment that the way to do that will be to take the CStorm database and use that to do regional studies or site-specific studies. What we have available right now, particularly, as I said, in the bays and rivers in terms of extreme water levels, is just really not adequate. The gauges are far apart, and as everyone knows, the bathymetry and the topography varies widely, and you simply can't take these measurements and just interpolate between them to look at what the future of flooding risk would be. So the modeling is going to do all of this. It's going to combine the sea level rise with the extreme water levels, and it will be available throughout these interior bays. So no, it's not a part of the comp study, but it's part. But the important work that would lead to that is being done as part of the study, you know, that is the forcing. And so studies that would follow on, either by the Corps, other federal, state, or local entities, would have the best available science.
Thanks, Jason. And then the second question from Hans Moritz, are recommendations for addressing present risks aligned with present vulnerability prioritization? And let me just give the third one as well. How will adaptive measures be shaped to address future vulnerabilities?
I might ask, let's see, are recommendations for addressing present risks aligned with present vulnerability prioritization? I think that this goes more toward some of the work that other members of the team are doing, looking at vulnerability. Dave, do you want to answer this one?
Sure, Jason. Yeah, I'll take a stab at this. addressing present risks aligned with present vulnerability prioritization. Just to speak to some of the risk and, again, how we wanted to show, you know, the vulnerability, we utilized various existing data sets that we have related to floodplain inundation mapping. Again, the scale that we're working with, we couldn't really get to the water surface elevations. So we needed to, in a 2D perspective, identify where, from an aerial extent, would be the risk. And so, as you'll see in the documentation, we wanted to be able to identify a low probability, high magnitude event, and we utilized the slosh data to identify what an inundation would be for a Category 4 maximum event. And the reason we selected that is, again, as part of a low probability event, which would result in extensive catastrophic damages. We wanted to be able to utilize that information to characterize risk within the study area, as well as potential residual risk from any opportunities for any type of flood risk management solutions, perhaps like a structural solution, for instance. And then from there, we were able to utilize the 100-year water surface elevation, the FEMA D firms that we have available to us, and also as it relates to the natural makespace features and more frequent events, we captured the 10-year water surface elevation. Again, this was an interpolation exercise, as Jason mentioned, from the gauge analysis that was completed, but for more frequent events, this was a little bit more, I guess, acceptable to be able to interpolate between the gauges and present that as an inundation. So from there, that's how we derived the 10-year. So from there, we were able to utilize the various floodplains to us to capture, I guess, from a relative perspective, the probability associated with the flood risk. And so, for example, a high-frequency event more associated with a lower magnitude event, we were able to capture that. For example, the 100-year would be more of a moderate to high event, and then the Category 4 would be a low probability event. So we were able to capture those floodplains and delineate what would be a relative higher probability of that event occurring to result in, you know, as relates to risk, with a higher probability of that risk and damages associated with it to occur. So that's where we were kind of pulled into the vulnerability presentation. You'll mention that, note that in the discussion, where we go from presenting the inundation mapping showing what could potentially be exposed to that inundation mapping, and then from there pulling in the probability from a relatively higher probability, higher frequency occurring that would be a more vulnerable situation because it's more susceptible to receive damages during a flood event, regardless of the frequency. But obviously, as it's the higher probability of it occurring, a low magnitude, lower magnitude event, the more damages that could occur. Hopefully that addresses some of that discussion there.
All right, and this is Jason. I think I can cover question number three.
Great.
The question is, how will adaptive measures be shaped to address future vulnerabilities? What we're doing with the comp study, this is something that's part of the ongoing work. I'm working with it and with the rest of the team. So we're basically developing climate change adaptation planning in a qualitative sense. That is, what we're going to do is discuss the path that should be taken to address this, because most of these adaptations would be rather site-specific or measure-specific. We're going to discuss how certain types of measures are more adaptable or might cover a longer, might be more resilient during in certain circumstances. So while we won't be analyzing actual adaptation plans across the entire region, it's too large of an area, but we are definitely going to delve into how that type of analysis should be done. And as we've said with the comp study all along, the study is intended to lay the groundwork for where vulnerabilities exist, where risks are higher, area, and to suggest where further study is needed. I think this is one of those that we lay out the general approach. And again, this is something that I'll talk about in much more detail at our webinar on this topic in a few weeks. But we are not going to give a particularly quantitative look at adaptive measures simply because of the scale.
Thanks, Jason. All right, and the next question, I think I'll start with Dave. This is from Fadi Kara, and he says, for various protection and mitigation measures, will you provide standards of life cycle cost analysis?
Cycle cost. I think the answer would be no. With respect to development of cost assessments, we utilize parametric unit costs, and a very general design for the various measures to develop what would be quantities to develop a unit cost for the various measures. As far as the life cycle costs, we did seek some of the operation and maintenance costs from various observations of similar measures that went into the development of the parametric unit costs. So those are captured for some of those measures. We also included some of the management components associated with that. That information is described in the appendix. So there would be a little bit more. If I could direct the question for the person to that particular measures appendix for more information to address that life cycle cost.
Great, thank you. Next, I have a series of questions. I think, Dave, they're all for you in terms of specifics about how this report gets reviewed. So the first one is from Robert Nyman, and he says, thanks for the opportunity to review the draft analysis. It wasn't clear from the schedule if there will be an agency review period for the draft report that will be produced in June, or if the April 14th deadline is our last opportunity.
Essentially, yes, this would be the last opportunity to provide input that gets into the documentation. There won't be an interagency review of the actual draft report. Again, we wanted to be able to, again, pull together draft analyses from our perspective, make it available to our interagency team to provide their input to help formulate and present in the draft report what we wanted to show as far as the framework is concerned and some of the information that's going to be ultimately submitted to Congress. So I guess the answer to your question is yes. However, we will have ongoing dialogue, questions that arise with some of the various team members associated with the comm study here at the Corps have been working with you on some other items and other initiatives, and we can continue to have some dialogue. We could also follow up with some of you individually following this comment period if there are comments that warrant further coordination. So we captured that as well as part of the detailed schedule. But again, what was presented was a milestone schedule as part of the presentation. And again, to answer your question, this would be the opportunity for you to provide input into this draft that would ultimately become the draft report.
Thanks, Dave. The next question for you from Megan McBuy is, if we haven't received access to the draft analysis, who should we contact to make sure we are on the email list to gain access as well as future invites to the subject-specific webinars?
I would quickly respond if you can follow up with your agency POC. Again, as we mentioned, the information that was submitted was part of a specific distribution list that was pre-coordinated with various agency points of contact that we generated as we've gone from the start of the study. So I'd advise you to take a look at your colleagues within your agency, and then from there work with them to provide input into the report if you want to continue participating.
Thanks, Dave. And I can address the next one. Yasser Atayar, sorry for mispronouncing your last name. You have the right link where the presentation will be posted. It's just not posted there yet. So I just want to check back with the presenters to see if you have any questions that have come to you directly that we're not all seeing. All right. And then we have a couple other comments in here that I'm going to skip for now. If any of the presenters want to address those, please just let me know. But I'm going to go down to Eric Myers has a question here. And I think this could probably go to Lynn or Jason or even Dave. So just jump in with your response. But let me go ahead and read it off. Looking at the MD appendix, I have an observation and question. From work we have been involved with on MD's, Maryland's, Eastern Shore, the loss risks are not always immediate, but result from impacts of storm surge. For example, dieback of coastal forests and freshwater vegetation that leads fairly quickly to accelerated erosion, loss of vegetated land cover, and generally accelerates the impact of sea level rise coupled with storm surge. Is there some possibility that these impacts will be addressed, at least in narrative, in NACCS?
Right. Maria, I can answer the question. Okay. Thank you, Eric, for participating and for the good question. And again, I just want to caveat my response here by indicating that we're looking at this study from the North Atlantic regional perspective. So the scale of the study and the analyses that are being completed, as well as the time frame to complete it, precludes us from really getting into the details. So that's what you're going to see as part of the initial illustrative evaluations that are being presented with respect to the exposure and the vulnerability. And that's not to say, however, Eric, that we do want to speak to some of these impacts narratively, and you'll find in, I think, Appendix P, the environmental appendix, where we work with our environmental teams across the Corps of Engineers North Atlantic Division to develop the narratives that would support what would be impacts from sea level rise with respect to the ecological resources, Furthermore, we've also worked with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to prepare a Planning Aid report that would be included as part of this study. As part of that scope with Fish and Wildlife Service, we've asked them to take a look at potential impacts to the ecological resources, primarily biological resources, from the impacts of sea level rise. So we are attempting to address some of the details narratively, but again, the scale really precludes us from really getting into the details. And again, we caveat that to say that, you know, future discussions and assessments will be required to be able to get more specific detailed information that you just hear in your comment and question. Again, we do try to capture the information as best we could within the constraints of the scale and time frame.
Thanks, Dave. So I have another question here from Nikita Storgis. And Dave, I think I'll direct it to you again first, and feel free to direct to other presenters as necessary. The question is, there was a mention of model validation. Has there been an attempt to quantify the vertical propagation of quantified uncertainty from model to model, say from ADCIRC to HEC-FIA, and is that incorporated somewhere in the report?
This is Lynn Bocamazzo. I think I'll handle that directly to Nikitas. The answer to this question is no. Again, as Dave mentioned, it's a scale thing. We are not attempting. I know we're going to include the uncertainty in the numerical model, the storm surge model. The meshing of the storm surge model with the HEC FIA model hasn't really been considered under this study. And I'm not sure about the uncertainty that will be included in Naomi's work on the depth damage curves. So, no, it would be great, but no.
Yeah, we'll discuss uncertainty. We will discuss residual risk, but it really won't be that there won't be that robust a calculation.
Great, thank you. And then I think I'll go ahead and read out a couple of the other comments we've got at the moment, because I'm not seeing any other questions come in. So just a comment for everybody on the phone. If you have any more questions, feel free to raise your hand or use the send note function to chat in any additional questions. And while we wait for those, I'll just read out a couple comments from Matthew Wall. The first one is, the 0.75 is probably for acquisition and demolition of structures in the flood zone. It's the minimum level a project must be before environmental benefits can be included. Other than that, the project must be a 1.0 or better in order to be fundable.
Okay. Thank you.
Helpful. Excellent. And then the second comment is, note that environmental benefits are brand new for FEMA and can only be included in acquisition projects that result in open spaces.
Okay.
Great. So any other comments back from the presenters on those points?
Now, you say that projects that result in open space, does it have to be completely open space, or can it be some built structures and some open space as well?
Matthew, can you turn on your mic in order to speak over the phone?
If you would like your line to be unmuted, simply dial *1, and I will proceed to do that. Or you may use the raise hand icon at the top left of your screen.
All right, Eddie, I see a hand raised. Yes, okay, we hear you.
Okay, if I'm unmuted, then what it is that the there can be no structures that interfere with the natural function of the open space area. It's open space in perpetuity.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I note a related comment that just came in. Alan Springett says, currently only open space is allowed. This is being discussed. Any other comments from the presenters on this point? Any other questions that the presenters may have received directly that were not sent to the moderators? All right, we'll just hold for another minute to see if anybody else wants to chime in with a question, either using the SendNote function or raising the hand. And if not, we'll go ahead and conclude the webinar. All right. Well, I'm not seeing anything come in. Eddie, are you seeing anything else come in on your end?
I do not see any further questions here in the queue.
Okay. So I think at this point we'll go ahead and conclude the webinar. I would like to thank all of the speakers very much for the information provided, and also thanks to all of the participants for calling in the good questions, the discussion, the information that you've provided that will help the team move this forward. We really appreciate your time and your feedback. With that, I will conclude the webinar for today. Thanks again to all of you for your time.